We don't have all the answers now, but we're working on them. And we're working on them very thoroughly because we can't afford to be wrong.
Solving the Trans-Alaska Pipeline's low-flow problem. From the Alaska Public Radio Network, this is Alaska News Nightly for Monday, November 4th. Good evening, I'm Lori Townsend. Also tonight, an unusual tree found near Sitka may reveal clues to a volcanic mystery.
From the geology point of view, the exciting part is this is the first time we'll be able to directly date that eruption.
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station. What do you dream for your community? Alaska Philanthropy Day celebrates those who share time, expertise, and money to make their dreams for better communities come true, like Gene Kaufman, who has volunteered at 54 nonprofit organizations, including Salvation Army Alaska. Join the celebration on November 7th at the Hotel Captain Cook in Anchorage. Visit afpalaska.afpnet.org. This message sponsored by Alaska Public Media and AFP Alaska.
The Trans-Alaska Pipeline System is the 800-mile-long backbone of the state's energy infrastructure. It's built to transport up to 2 million barrels of oil per day. But these days, it carries only about a quarter of that. With oil production at lower levels, how long will the pipeline be viable? Alyeska Pipeline Service Company is exploring new ways to keep the system up and running. APRN's Ann Hillman found out more.
The 36-year-old Trans-Alaska Pipeline marches south from the North Slope across squishy tundra, mighty rivers, and high mountain passes on its way to Prince William Sound. The system that monitors that pipeline is a bit less romantic.
Well, here's a station control panel.
It's a beige cabinet.
And all these are now a bunch of Ethernet cables for communications between the various programmable logic controllers, or PLCs.
Mike Malvik is a senior processing engineer advisor for Alyeska Pipeline Services Company. He takes me on a tour of the pipeline's operations control center in Anchorage.
Upon pipeline startup, there was a computerized control system, but it was a lot more primitive in that it used mechanical relay switches and vacuum tubes.
Now, pipeline controllers sit in a quiet room filled with massive monitors. The screens show schematics that look sort of like 1980s video games. Symbols indicate which valves are open and the direction the oil is headed.
Following the blue line, the oil's going to tank number 5 today.
Controllers monitor pressure, temperature, and flow. They respond to alarms and communicate with workers in the field. It's extremely mellow during a normal day, as the controllers try to keep the oil flowing at a steady state. But Melvick explains that maintaining the steady state is harder when less oil is flowing through the system. With only about 550,000 barrels entering the pipeline per day, the oil gets colder much faster.
And if you get to the freeze point, then you can start making ice in the pipeline, coating critical valves, collecting in low spots of the pipe, and then when we run a cleaning pig, have that cleaning pig pick up that ice and bring it into a pump station and plug the pump station up.
A cleaning pig looks like an 8-foot-long shish kebab of mushrooms and quarters. It scrapes the inside of the pipeline and pushes wax and ice out of the system. The problem is, they only work if the oil is moving fast enough to push them along. In the next few years, it may not be. Less oil makes leaks harder to detect as well. So how low is too low?
We haven't firmly landed on that number because we're still studying it.
Part of the study includes a new pipeline model decked out with all of the same types of monitors and equipment as the real pipeline, just in miniature. It's being built at the University of Tulsa.
What we've designed the test loop at Tulsa to do is simulate as closely as we can, if I was a drop of oil going from pump one to Valdez, what temperature variations would I see? What terrain types would I see?
Starting this month, they'll run oil from the North Slope through the model. They want to test new ideas like dry flow. It's deceptively simple. Oil pumped from the ground naturally contains water. If you let it sit in large tanks for a few hours, the water drops out. Less water in the oil could solve problems like ice buildup and pipe corrosion. Louis Epstein is a petroleum engineer with the Wilderness Society and vice president of the Pipeline Safety Trust. She says studying the technical problem is the best solution to the low flow issue.
from my perspective as an engineer, the things they're looking at right now seem to make a lot of sense.
Epstein says she trusts that Alyeska, which operates the pipeline on behalf of its owners, has motivation to find a way to keep taps running for decades to come.
The major operators on the North Slope don't want to leave the crude in the ground. They've already done the exploration. They've set up the pipeline infrastructure. They want to see it go to market. So there's, from a commercial standpoint, from an economic standpoint, they're going to make sure that TAPS is viable over the long run.
From an environmental standpoint, she would rather the companies make use of the infrastructure and oil fields that are already there instead of developing places like Anwar. As Alyeska waits for the study results, they're dealing with the low flow problem by adding extra heat to the oil. They have restarted some pump stations where they cycle the oil through multiple times. The friction heats it up before it heads back down the line. Another possible solution is storing oil in tanks at pump station 1 and only running the pipeline part-time. But Malvik says starting it and stopping it in the winter has problems of its own.
We don't have all the answers now, but we're working on them. And we're working on them very thoroughly because we can't afford to be wrong. We have to get it right.
He's hoping the answers from Tulsa will help the pipeline run efficiently and safely far into the future. For APRN, I'm Ann Hillman.
Construction on a subsea pipeline to bring crude from the west side of Cook Inlet to Nikiski could start as early as February, KDLL's Shaylin Cochran reports.
The project that's been submitted to the Department of Natural Resources for consideration is basically the same as the one Cook Inlet Energy pitched last year, a 29-mile-long, 8-inch diameter U-shaped pipeline joining production facilities in Custatan with refining operations in Nikiski. The work is being done by a subsidiary of Tesoro, a limited liability corporation called the Trans-Foreland Pipeline Company, which is wholly owned by Tesoro. Calls for comment from the company were not returned in time for the story, but last month, Cook Inlet Regional Citizens Advisory Council spokesperson Linda Jaguer told the Kenai Chamber of Commerce a pipeline is the way to go.
And although we are extremely supportive of Hillcorp's efforts at the Drift River Terminal, we believe a pipeline is just safer. We understand that construction may begin as early as next year to provide an alternative means of transporting crude oil across the inlet. And we've invited Tesoro to present their plans and status of the project at our December meeting in Anchorage as well.
The Drift River Terminal is one of many reasons for installing the pipeline. It's a tank farm located at the base of Mount Redoubt. And when the volcano erupted in 2009, production was shut down entirely with thousands of barrels of oil left at the site. An easy-to-see cause for concern for environmentalists, and because of lost productivity, a concern for the industry as well. That's cited in the project description Trans-Foreland submitted to DNR. The company calls it, quote, eliminating the business interruption risk of volcanic activity and ice movements to oil shipments through Drift River Terminal. What this means for the terminal is unclear. Hillcorp spokesperson Lori Nelson says the pipeline doesn't change their plans.
Well, right now in the process, it really means nothing. There are really too many commercial and regulatory uncertainties surrounding the Trans-Foreland's pipeline project right now for us to make any definitive decisions moving forward. We're going to continue to operate the terminal safely and responsibly, just as it's been done for the last 40 years.
The design life for the pipeline is 30 years, and it will be continuously computer monitored for leaks or changes in flow or pressure that will move more than 60,000 barrels per day. Reporting from Kenai, I'm Shaylin Cochran.
The fishing vessel Arctic Hunter is still on the rocks outside Unalaska after running aground Friday morning. As KUCB's Annie Ropeek reports, the vessels weathered a series of storms without spilling any oil.
Coast Guard Public Affairs Officer Sean Eggert says the Coast Guard is investigating what caused the accident.
Our understanding right now is that the ship's master was asleep at the wheel when the vessel initially ran aground.
The Arctic Hunter grounded outside on Alaska early Friday morning and began taking on water. The crew issued a distress call around 4 a.m. They abandoned ship and were picked up by the Good Samaritan fishing vessel Saga. After that, the Arctic Hunter dislodged and drifted 5 miles down the coast outside of Morris Cove, where it's stuck now. Unalaska public safety officers and Coast Guard personnel met up with the Saga around 7 a.m. Public Safety Director Jamie Sunderland says they administered a field sobriety test to the skipper, which he passed. But Sunderland says the skipper failed a breathalyzer test.
He provided a sample for the PBT that would have been slightly over the allowed limit.
The skipper allegedly told police that he had a drink after the accident, not before. Sunderland says the crew corroborated that account. The Coast Guard will handle any further investigation. In Unalaska, I'm Annie Ropeek.
Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, a far-fetched idea to bring the U.S. and Canada closer together.
And I just thought, okay, well, let's imagine, and this is where it becomes a thought experiment, how we could merge these two.
That's ahead. Stay with us.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station.
The Kinnick Arm Bridge and Toll Authority is developing the Kinnick Arm Crossing to further develop the transportation system between Anchorage and the Mat-Su Borough. The bridge could create construction jobs, provide access to land for commercial, industrial, and residential development, and shorten the route to Alaska's interior and North Slope. There's more information on the Kinnick Arm Bridge at kinnickarmbridge.com. This message sponsored by the Kinnick Arm Bridge and Toll Authority.
When it comes to retirement benefits, the state is looking at a $12 billion shortfall. Just how that's going to be paid off is expected to be a big issue for the legislature next session. APRN's Alexander Gutierrez reports that the Parnell administration is thinking about putting hundreds of millions of dollars into the state's retirement funds to help close the gap.
So let's just get this out of the way. Alaska is not Detroit. It is not currently at risk of going bankrupt. It is not even at risk of breaking its constitutional obligation of paying out retirement benefits. But having billions in unfunded liabilities will put constraints on current and future budgets. If you have to dip into the state's general fund to cover pensions, that means less money for infrastructure projects, school operations, and the other things that government pays for. Chris Ershinger is part of the Alaska Retirement Management Board. And she says the pension shortfall is already having an impact on the state's budgeting process.
The unfunded liability of the retirement system is astronomical, and it will have, it does have and will continue to have a significant effect on the state of Alaska going forward.
Because of the dot-com bust and faulty actuarial projections, the state's had a gap in its retirement system for over a decade. But the retirement burden really grew in 2008. When the state lost a fifth of the money it had saved because of the recession. There are a few ways the state can slow the growth of or even shrink the unfunded liability, and it's already taken some serious measures. It closed the pension system to new state workers a few years ago and put them on 401k-style plans. The state is also making scheduled payments to reduce the shortfall, and it also hopes to see a high rate of return on the investments it already has. The Alaska Retirement Management, or ARM Board, wants to do even more to get the state's unfunded liability in check. On Friday, Ershinger presented to the Senate Finance Committee, and she made the case that injecting more money into the retirement fund now would be better for the state's financial health in the long term.
The point of that isn't just to get more money in the system, it's so that that money can earn interest that will pay pension benefits, reducing the need for future contributions from the state down the road.
The ARM Board would like to see the state put $2 billion into its retirement fund spread out over 4 years. On top of this cash infusion, the board wants the state to front-load the payments it's already making to cover the unfunded liability. Because the cost of those payments is expected to rise with time, Ershinger argues it's better to pay more of that money now while the state still has flush budget reserves.
So the pain is going to be very real very quickly, but it's going to result in less pain down the road when the state of Alaska is less likely to be able to pay for the pain because of lower oil revenues.
Because pension payments are split between the state and municipalities, Ershinger also says that dealing with the unfunded liability sooner rather than later would give cities more financial security and flexibility with their budgets, since this problem is weighing on them too. At Friday's meeting, officials from the Parnell administration said there was an emerging consensus for putting some lump sum amount into the retirement system, but that they didn't have a particular number in mind yet. As far as the ARM Board's plan to front-load contributions from the state here on out, that got a little bit of pushback from the state's Legislative Finance Division, a nonpartisan state agency that advises lawmakers on budget issues. Director David Teal cautioned against overreaction. He He says the state is already on a plan to close the unfunded liability without putting extra pressure on the budget for the next decade.
The road to recovery from large losses can be very long, so long that the system can appear to be broken. And I think that's where we are right now, as people think the system is broken. I would argue that the system is unlikely to stay broken in the long run, because if you pay what you owe, the system will fix itself.
The governor will reveal just how much of the state's budget he's willing to put toward bolstering the retirement system when he releases his budget next month. In Juneau, I'm Alexandra Gutierrez.
A federal judge has dismissed complaints challenging National Park Service regulations of waters inside park boundaries. As KUAC's Dan Bross reports, this week's ruling is the latest volley in a long-running battle between the state and federal government.
Anchorage moose hunter John Sturgeon filed suit after the Park Service banned him from using a hovercraft on the Nation River in the Yukon Charley Rivers National Preserve. The state contested the agency's requiring a research permit for work on the Alagnak River in Katmai National Park. Alaska and federal laws provide for state ownership of most navigable waters. The Park Service maintained some authority over waters within conservation units and exercised those in 1996 with new regulations. National Park Service spokesman John Quinley says the ruling by U.S. District Judge H. Russell Holland affirms existing agency authority.
The 1996 regulations did not expand our authority, but clarified it, and the court has upheld our application of those regulations.
Quinley says having state-regulated rivers inside parks would be problematic to resource management and protection. John Sturgeon's attorney, Matthew Finley, says it affirms National Park Service authority to override the state.
Essentially accepts the federal government's argument that basically at any time it seeks to extend its regulations to apply to state-owned lands within park boundaries, that gets around the very statutory prohibition against doing so, and they get to do it. It's very circular, but that's the argument they made, and that's one Judge Holland accepted.
Finley says Sturgeon is considering an appeal to the Ninth Circuit Court. So is the state of Alaska. Senior Assistant Attorney General Ann Nelson says the case is very important, as the ruling undermines the 1980 Alaska National Interest Lands Conservation Act that created many Alaska parks but shielded Encompass state property from federal regulation.
ANILCA clearly says that state-owned lands and waters and private-owned lands and waters within national parks in Alaska are not part of the park and are not to be regulated as such. So we think the decision's inconsistent with the statute and the core of ANILCA's grand compromise.
Similar issues are being considered in another case working its way through the court system. Central resident Jim Wild is also challenging National Park Service authority on navigable waters in parks. Wild was convicted of misdemeanor charges stemming from a scuffle with National Park Service rangers during a boat safety inspection on the Yukon River inside Yukon Charley Preserve back in 2010. The Park Service's Quinley emphasizes there are greater goals at issue than who's in charge.
The origin of regulatory cases has been an interest in providing for both public safety and protection of resources within national park units, and we hope we can really work with the state of Alaska to achieve those goals, knowing that the legal arguments may continue.
Jim Wild appealed his conviction, and the state has filed for amicus status on Wild's behalf. The case is pending in U.S. District Court. In Fairbanks, I'm Dan Bross.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by Wells Fargo, proud supporter of APRN and dedicated to having conversations that help businesses and individuals succeed financially, because an open dialogue can open doors. Wells Fargo, together we'll go far. Those living with asthma know that each day their life can take several different routes. So take care of yourself with daily medication and you'll be well rested and eager to take on the day. Miss taking your medication and you'll end up with restless sleep, days at home sick, or even in the emergency room. So treat your asthma even when you're feeling your best to keep you from your worst. Information at asthmainalaska.org or 1-800-LUNG-USA. This message sponsored by the American Lung Association.
The United States and Canada are friendly neighbors with many common cultural and business interests. A new book suggests that partnership should be formalized. The title, Merger of the Century, Why Canada and America Should Become One Country, succinctly defines the premise. Author and dual citizen Diane Francis says because Canada has vast undeveloped resources, but scant population and military, it needs the U.S. to help develop and protect what America also needs.
The free trade agreement was signed 26 years ago. The border is worse than it was before it was signed. And it's not just national security fears, it's drug smuggling out of Canada, it's all kinds of things. And so we have all these other problems to consider. And I just thought, okay, well, let's imagine, and this is where it becomes a thought experiment, how we could merge these two. And I looked at the German thing where you just go headlong into a full-on merger, where Canada gets 13 states and all kinds of money for its untapped resources and all that sort of thing, or a European Union type of merger and a lot of things in between, like a joint venture for the North.
How do you think that things would be different? Let's back up to the issue of China pressuring Canada for resources. How would it be different if the two countries merged rather than the United States and Canada today working together on who should be getting access to these resources?
Well, right now, Canada has the resources, the U.S. is the customer. And so that's the relationship. But there are issues about that. And the Chinese have made great forays into Canada. They made the largest foreign takeover anywhere in the world in Canada this year, a big oil company, which they haven't been allowed to do in other jurisdictions, developed jurisdictions. So we've allowed them in. Public opinion was dead set against it. We're having a problem getting the Keystone Line approved. The red tape and bureaucracy along the border is choking our manufacturing and our commodities industries. We've got to get closer together to get this to work better and the way it could work. So whatever way in which that could be done is very important for us to consider. Both countries by us, that's what I mean. And, you know, I look at Alaska. I look at how beautifully developed Alaska is. And not everybody may not agree with it, but Alaska has seven times the population of Yukon, Nunavut, and Northwest Territories. Three times the population. You have a heritage fund. You have royalty payments. You have railway. You have seaports. You have cities. You have an oil pipeline that was built in 8 years from discovery. We discovered oil and gas when you discovered Prudhoe. We don't even have a permit for the pipeline. So the problem in Canada is that the government is not interested, doesn't have the money, and it's been ignored and neglected. And the world is not going to let us leave it that way.
I talked to a reporter friend about this book who said, well, this is preposterous. This would never happen. Do you think that this is a feasible idea?
It's not preposterous at all. In 1985, a gentleman who was a member of the Liberal government in Canada did exactly the same thing I've done, and he spent 3 years with the Royal Commission studying what Canada should do because it was, again, facing existential challenges going forward. He came out with a shocking idea, and that was free trade with the United States was the only hope for Canada's survival. Everybody said it was preposterous. Everybody threw him, his idea, and his recommendations under the bus, and 2 years later, a deal was signed.
Diane Francis is the author of the new book, Merger of the Century, Why Canada and America Should Become One Country. You probably already know about mountain ash trees. They're all over Southeast, known for their red berries that attract flocks of birds. Here's a story about a different kind of ash tree, one recently discovered in a big pile of volcanic debris. Coast Alaska's Ed Schoenfeld has the story.
Word came late summer of an unusual natural relic found near the Mount Edgecombe volcano just west of Sitka. So a group of scientists and friends headed out for a look. University of Alaska botanist Kitty Labounty says it was a scramble.
They kind of led us through this big pile of, you know, logs and all that back up into a creek area where the bank had been cut enough away that you could see this pretty amazing tree.
What they found was upright and largely intact, but it wasn't petrified.
It actually looked like a tree, like a charcoal tree, but the outline was pretty amazing. And when you looked up at it up close, you could see all the structure in the tree. You could see where some of the roots were, some of the branches. You could see knots actually still in the structure of the tree.
It was embedded in pumice, an extremely porous rock created during explosive volcanic eruptions. Now you may know pumice as a rough granular stone sold as a cosmetic and used to scrape away dried skin. Geologist Jim Bechtel says this pumice fell as powder, grain, and rocks, and it quickly buried the tree.
It looks like it's still in growth position, but it was so hot that it basically completely charcoalized the tree in place.
And it didn't fall apart because it was held in place by the pumice until now.
From the geology point of view, the exciting part is this is the first time we'll be able to directly date that eruption.
Bechtel says the volcanic material came from Crater Ridge, one of several volcanic features near Mount Edgecumbe. He's sent off some pumice and charred wood for testing.
We've got enough samples that we can get the chemistry of what the eruption was, and that will tell us too, because each of those individual vents has a slightly different chemistry.
Bechtel says the information will be added to existing research on the volcanoes of Kruzoff Island, where Crater Ridge and Mount Edgecumbe stand. It will also help shape a larger view of the many volcanoes, cinder cones, and lava flows found in southeast Alaska. Scientists already know the massive weight of Ice Age glaciers, which used to cover most of southeast, pushed down the region's landforms, and as they melted and retreated, it rose back up.
And we're thinking that the eruptions are tied to fractures opening and closing with the warping of the Earth's crust at or soon after deglaciation.
From a geologist's perspective, southeast remains volcanically active. Its most recent lava flow, north of Ketchikan, happened around the 1800s. The region continues to see shrinking glaciers and thinning ice fields, but Bechtel says it's not on a large enough scale to expect eruptions anytime soon. This is Ed Schoenfeld reporting from Sitka.
The charcoal tree was discovered by a young Sitkan, Blake LaPerriere. You can see photos of the tree, which may be a spruce, on our website, alaskapublic.org. And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. If you missed any of tonight's stories, we're online at alaskapublic.org, and you can follow us on Twitter at APRN. We had reports tonight from Shaylin Cochran in Kenai, Dan Bross in Fairbanks, and Ed Schoenfeld in Sitka. APRN's Alexandra Gutierrez reported from Juneau, and Ann Hillman from Anchorage. Our editor and producer is Annie Feit. Our audio engineer is Dave Waldron. Josh Edge is our web producer, and I'm Lori Townsend. Good night.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible by Northern Air Cargo. Since 1956, Alaskans have entrusted Northern Air Cargo to transport their freight. Thank you, Alaska, for the opportunity to serve you for decades to come. Join Alaska bars and restaurants from every corner of the state in taking a stand against secondhand smoke. The fact of the matter is, no Alaskan, employee, or customer should suffer the heart disease and lung cancer due to secondhand smoke. The benefits are undeniably positive for Alaskans and for the bottom line. Clean indoor air. It's good for health, and it's great for business. For more information on smoke-free workplaces, visit alaskatca.org. This message sponsored by the Alaska Tobacco Control Alliance. Calling all Alaskan artists. Alaska Public Media's annual art showcase and auction is February 6th through the 8th. This unique opportunity features Alaskan artists and their work in fine arts media in a live auction, televised around the state and in an online catalog. Deadline for submission is December 16th. Visit alaskapublic.org for more information. Proceeds benefit Alaska Public Media.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.